This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
David Shreve is a former professor at the University of Virginia with a joint appointment at the Miller Center of Public Affairs in the Department of History. He is a specialist on 20th century U.S. political history and economic policy. He studied economic history at Louisiana State University, and he's a member of the Virginia Organizing Project Tax Reform Committee. His forthcoming book is American Promise, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and the Forging of the Modern Economy. David Shreve joins me live in studio. How are you, David? Happy Monday.
Doing well. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me in.
Absolutely. Coy. Thanks for being here. Been looking forward to it. What is the Virginia Organizing Project?
The Virginia Organizing Project is a statewide organization that endeavors to bring people in the community into discussions about the directions of their lives and the public servants who serve them and whom they elect to serve them in Richmond and around the state, local and state level. As the name would suggest, it's all about organizing folks, citizens, to get involved. And, of course, we do it with an eye toward progressive reforms.
Jefferson would be proud.
Indeed.
An organization in Virginia trying to get people more involved in politics. Very interesting. So you are the author of an op-ed published just a few weeks ago in the Virginian Pilot regarding the tax system in Virginia, and specifically through the window of this campaign for governor that we just were talking about with Bob Holdsworth. You heard that conversation.
I did, yes.
What are your thoughts?
I listened with great interest because I found myself nodding at almost every turn. One thing I would add that might turn the conversation in a slightly different direction is that I feel that whoever the next governor turns out to be will not be so hemmed in by the economy or by the fiscal dilemma that he will face. Now, there will be a dilemma and there will be problems. There's no doubt about that. But they're not as intractable as we tend to think.
So they're not out of their right mind to be talking about new spending then?
Well,
or are they?
No. Although I would think that if they were honest, they would be talking about preservation of existing spending. You know, what we should be avoiding, and I commend Governor Kaine for having done a decent job, a very good job even of doing just this, is avoiding the large cuts. You know, what economists call this when we look at state behavior during recessions is a pro-cyclical response, which essentially means that we dig ourselves even deeper into the ditch when we use a cuts-only approach. Now, why do you do that? Well, in theory, we have to have a balanced budget. It's actually not well known that we don't really have to have that all the time, and there are ways to actually undertake a little deficit spending, but that's a different matter altogether. We tend to have that response, and it's very similar to what happens in the other 49 states as well. Virginia's not an outlier here, and that is that we tend to see no room for any change on the tax front. And therefore, the only possible response, if you decide to balance the budget, then is to cut. As I said, that kind of a response is exactly what you don't want in a recession.
And why is that? Because we often hear people, and it almost sounds like a no-brainer. Well, you have less money, government. You should
tighten its belt as well.
You should make a whole lot of cuts and give me back more of what you took, because I've got less too.
Well, I hate to do economist speak, but you know, it kind of goes back to that first page of most economics textbooks where they tell you what comprises GDP, C plus G plus I. It's consumption plus government spending plus investment. If consumption and investment are down, government spending has got to go up, or the whole economy is going to keep going down. So it's a counter-cyclical type operation that we've known for years works the way John Maynard Keynes mapped it out back in the 1930s, and history will show us that indeed our governments at all levels can engage in this. Now, admittedly, the states and local governments have far less discretion and maneuvering room than does our federal government. We really have to rely upon them. But the response needs to be countercyclical like that.
But it is a bit counterintuitive for most people to see, especially the federal government, increasing spending during a recession.
I suppose it is. One maybe easier way of seeing this is that if we engage in deficit spending on the federal level, what that simply means is the federal government is putting more money into the economy than it's taking out. That's what you want. The opposite would be to run a surplus, let's say, you know, to bring in more tax dollars than you're spending, to cut your spending back so much, that would be doing the opposite. That would be putting less back into the economy than you're taking out, which would hammer us, even, you know, as I said, drive us even further into the ditch.
Now, what's your response to some folks who might be thinking, well, if the government did cut taxes and spend less, they could give me more money and I could consume more and the C could go up?
Well, if it's focused on C,
consumption.
Yes, consumption. You can get a little bang for that. The trouble is, most of the schemes that we develop when we do those sort of things don't do that. It's more of a trickle down supply side approach where people who are sitting on the sideline take that extra money and park it and don't send it back into the economy.
That is the lesson of all the studies, that you give more money, they're not going to consume more. They pay off debt and save.
Yeah, and the same holds true for consumers as well, to an extent. You know, if you had a choice, if somebody put it to you and say, the only thing we can do, darn it, is a tax cut. Tell me what kind of tax cut. Well, it's got to go to those folks at the bottom of the heap, really, in the lowest rungs of the income ladder. They're the ones who are going to turn around and spend it the quickest and send it back into the economy. Anything less than that, or away, the further you move away from that kind of an approach, the less bang for your buck.
So this idea that we've been told for years that if you give the tax cuts to the wealthy, that money will trickle down and it'll go out into the economy. Studies show that they actually don't spend it.
Yeah, no,
they park it.
Well, they in general. I mean, you know, those savings are the source of all investment. But the key to understanding how the whole thing works is that the investor is not going to move unless that investor sees some hope for a return in the near future or the medium distant future. You know, usually our investors don't have the kind of foresight that we want them to have, and they're moving quarter by quarter, that sort of a thing. So the risk is great that they're going to park it. Whereas if it goes into a public investment, schools, transportation, healthcare, that's moving right immediately back into the economy. And that's what you want at a time like this.
My guest is economic historian David Shreve. He's with the Tax Reform Committee on the Virginia Organizing Project, which is virginia-organizing.org. David, tell me, what is the proposal that your committee is putting forth, especially when it comes to, you referred to the outdated tax system that Virginia has?
Well, we don't have a single proposal as yet. In fact, one of the things that we're doing on the committee on which I serve is discussing possible options. Now, I've written op-eds and I've written white papers for the committee over the last few years in which we've floated some proposals. All of them take a similar form, so I can speak to that anyway. And the idea is that Virginia, along with the other states in the union, have, you could say, either outdated tax structures, and that refers mostly to the way in which they impose income taxes. But overall, when you include sales, property, and excise taxes as well, and I always argue, and our committee always argues, that when you look at the tax structure in Virginia, you have to look at the whole thing, not just one part of it. And we're often guilty, policymakers, journalists, et cetera, of not doing that. So when you look at the whole structure is regressive. And what that means simply is that the rate of taxation on the basis of income goes up as your income decreases. That's upside down. And there's a lot of ramifications of that, none of which are good.
Now, that's not what we learned in school. We learned in school that America has a progressive tax structure, but that's not what we have anymore.
Well, if you focus on the federal structure, it is. And, you know, again, not only are we guilty of compartmentalizing the various tax vehicles on the state level and ignoring part of, you know, a lot of the moving parts. And I would argue that, you know, we have proxies for taxes, too, that have crept in. Virginia is ranked by a number of different surveys to be at least in the top 10, perhaps in the top five for states that use fees and surcharges, what I would call hidden taxes. That's becoming increasingly popular around the country. And what I was getting ready to say was that, you know, you should even consider something like parking tickets to be a tax, you know, and it's there was an article in, I think, The Washington Post, it might have been The New York Times a few days ago, in which they described how cities are jacking up their parking ticket rates and trying to use that as a source of revenue.
Well, we're seeing Ogmore County just a few weeks ago approved red light cameras at Rio and Pantops and some other place as well. And that's a revenue stream. They're basically using the police department to create a hidden tax.
One of the other problems we have with tax policy in general is that it gets ensnared in debates about other things, such as a cigarette tax, which is often promoted as a way to promote health.
Yeah.
And it is. And it's proven that it does. It induces people to either quit smoking or smoke less. But on a tax, pure tax basis, it's one of the most regressive vehicles we can have. And so it really hurts poor people. So if you want to do it to promote health.
Because more poor people smoke?
No, not so. That's not clear. But what is clear is that the percentage of their income they spend on their smokes is higher than the rich person who, even if he smokes at the same level, that's just a drop in the bucket.
Because there's so much more income, so it's a much smaller percentage.
On the basis of income, which is the only thing that matters, by the way, when it comes to taxes. We hear a lot of talk about, you know, there's folks promoting the so-called fair tax, and I laugh when they say it's really a progressive tax, and it's progressive based on spending. Well, that's a misnomer. You know, the definition of progressive has to do with how that tax bears upon a person's income, not spending. And so that's what matters here. And so again, if you're looking at the tobacco tax, for example, if you want to use it to promote health, fine, move it to the side, but don't count on it for revenue. Don't make it an integral part of your revenue structure, or you're going to be disappointed in a lot of different ways.
So what do the candidates need to be talking about, and what do our legislators need to do in Virginia to fix what you say is an outdated tax structure?
Well, it's partly outdated. It's partly backwards. The outdated part refers to the income tax code. We have a bracket structure in Virginia, and actually there's 15, 16 states like Virginia in this same pot of water, where they haven't been updated since the 19-teens or 20s in most cases. In Virginia's case, it's the 1920s, where most of the brackets haven't been adjusted. We essentially have Governor Harry Byrd's tax structure on our, and what that means is when Harry Byrd was governor, they were actually, they represented progressive rate structure. The $17,000 where the top rate kicks in today was a pretty high income back in the 1920s. And it hasn't been updated, you know, adjusted for inflation. So that's what we mean by antiquated. And what that means in practical terms is that we have a flat tax, essentially, not a progressive one. And again, there are about 15 states that share that vicissitude. There are 9 states with flat taxes, period. So about half of the states, in other words, have essentially flat taxes, not progressive. And the flat tax states, the 9 of the states that have that, you couldn't argue that they're archaic or antiquated. They just embraced a flat tax and stuck with it. The other problems, which are, it's not so much a problem of antiquity as much as it is just being upside down and backward, is that we rely too heavily as states, and Virginia is actually less guilty of this than other states, on sales and property taxes, which are regressive and which really hurt us in the long run.
And they're regressive because the folks who make less money, that tax is a higher percentage of their income.
Exactly. That's how you define that. And sales taxes.
So the less money you make, the more your money is going to the government.
Yeah. Well, on a percentage basis,
yeah.
Percentage of your income. Right. And that does a couple of things. One, it makes it difficult to raise adequate revenue to keep pace with the needs of a modern society, even to keep pace with inflation. It also imposes drag on the economy because those folks, at the bottom of the income ladder are the ones who turn around and spend every dime they make and put it right back into the economy. And if you're taking a greater percentage away from the working class and the lower middle class and the middle class than you are everybody else, it really dampens that C, that consumption that we talked about earlier,
yeah.
And which in turn dampens investment, and it, you know, drags.
Well, that hurts all
down.
The stores and the entrepreneurs and the
exactly.
folks who rely on consumption.
Exactly. And in fact, you know, if there's one secret to why the United States did so well economically throughout the 20th century, is that we embraced the opposite approach. Dominated by the federal government, and the states and localities kind of kicking and screaming and being dragged along. But we realized that a progressive structure would induce economic activity. And by God, when we did that, really, and the key change was in World War II, the post-war boom took off almost, you know, directly as a result of that key change.
Yeah.
And states, the problem here with states is that for a number of historical reasons, they feel that they can't embrace that same logic.
Certainly, it would be for many folks, especially in Virginia, to stand up and say, I want a more progressive tax structure. And I think the folks who make more money need to pay more taxes in Virginia. It's going to be political suicide for a lot of folks.
You do, yeah. And it's not so the difficulty in both explaining this and then trying to get it passed and implemented is that it sounds like soak the rich. It's not. It's more akin to a system in which the old phrase that the reformers used in the progressive era was taxation based on ability to pay. And they often defined ability to pay as the ability to help oneself. So that the more you were able to help yourself get through, the more you were expected to kind of chip in, to pay for the kinds of investments that give us civilization, the roads, the schools, the healthcare that our whole society requires.
We are talking with economic historian David Shreve. He's a member of the Virginia Organizing Project. We'll continue this conversation on the other side. A break for local news and weather. This is Charlottesville Right Now. We got about 22 minutes before 6 o'clock here in Central Virginia. It's 83 degrees. This is Charlottesville Right Now. Coming up in the next hour at 6:08 on the clock, stay tuned for Best Seat in the House. Jay James is taking your phone calls. Sound off about the UVA Cavaliers' performance on Saturday. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll talk with Dan Willingham about Back to School, David Swanson, best-selling author, and Brian Wheeler of Charlottesville tomorrow. David Shreve is live in studio. He is a member of the Virginia Organizing Project Tax Reform Committee and author of the forthcoming book, American Promise, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and the Forging of the Modern Economy. He's a former professor at the University of Virginia and an economic historian. David, we were talking in the break about specific reform ideas that you would like to see the candidates for governor talking about that perhaps they're not talking enough about. What are some of those ideas?
Well, I guess, first of all, it'd be worth pointing out that there is plenty of room for change, so that they're not hemmed in as much as they think they might be. My rule of thumb is that if you have trouble following all the moving parts and the ins and outs of the debate, that if you move toward a greater reliance on an income tax and make that income tax a little more progressive, you're moving in the right direction. So all of the reforms that we've discussed at VOP have to do with that kind of a change. Now, you can swap out sales taxes and property taxes for income taxes and do it in a revenue neutral way, which is also good. Or if you need new revenue, as I think we will in the next couple of years, you do it where it's not so revenue neutral. But to give you an example of one of the reforms we've proposed, you could change a prominent deduction on the Virginia personal income tax code without raising a single rate and raise about $1.5 billion. And this would bend our curve, the state tax curve, in a progressive direction, raising that kind of money.
How do you do it? What do you do?
Well, Virginians get to deduct from their taxable Virginia income the amount that they deduct on their federal returns in terms of the itemized deductions. So if you don't do that, you get a standard deduction, $6,000 for a joint return. If you have a deductibility, let's say, of $20,000 to $30,000 on your federal return, mortgage interest, charitable contributions, so on down the line, you get to take that greater amount. And of course, it's not difficult to imagine that the folks who are going to take those greatest amounts are the folks with the highest incomes here in Virginia. So we have an essentially flat income tax code as it stands, and this bends it even more in a, almost a regressive direction.
We're talking with economic historian David Shreve, and the phone lines are open at 977-1070. BW is on the line on line one. You go right ahead. You're on with David Shreve.
I just had a simple question about the extent to which his formulas or models take into account the off-the-books income enjoyed by a significant number of Americans, and I'll just hang up and listen to that, because apparently alternative tax proposals, he believes, are based on expenditures as opposed to income, and I want to know the extent to which his model takes into account off-the-books income that's earned all over the United States, including Virginia.
Thanks for the call, BW. Appreciate it.
Well, this is a significant problem with all tax codes. Admittedly, the models that I use tend to assume that you can't find some of this. People do cheat, and they do hide income. One of the proponents of moving toward a sales tax, and I would add a more regressive sales tax, argue that one of the positive features of that is that you therefore can't hide it as readily, because you're being taxed when you spend it, not when you earn it. That is a positive benefit. It's one of the few, I think, of such an approach. And it's, but the key to understanding it is, again, look at the big picture. Look at all the taxes, the way in which the whole structure works. That benefit is far outweighed by the negative repercussions of moving to such an approach. So therefore, I'm afraid we're doomed unless we jack up the number of auditors that we have and we intrude into the books of American businesses and personal financial affairs a little more readily than we do now.
I think average American Joes like me should be able to say that all my money was earned in the Bahamas, and I could park it down there and not have to pay any taxes.
Yeah. Now, on balance, it's not as big a problem as some think, and that's attributable to the system that we installed in the 1940s, by which we withhold income on a paycheck basis. And that, you know, everybody doesn't fall under that system, of course, and there are people who can hide their income, drug dealers included. But by and large, it accounts for most Americans and most Virginians.
We're talking with economic historian David Shreve, and the phone lines are open at 977-1070. Now, you started talking about this, but I'd like to hear more your thoughts on this whole idea of the what's called the fair tax. Neil Bortz has spoken about it quite a bit. What is it exactly, and what's good and bad about it?
Well, what's good about it is that it's it recognizes two problems. One is complexity, and I would be the first to agree that our federal, let's look at that's a federal proposal. It's not a state proposal. Our federal income tax code is far too complex, and there's a good historical or bad historical reason for that, which I could get into on another show perhaps, but they do address that issue. The other issue, which is relatively a minor part of it, is that they recognize clearly that the payroll tax on which we depend to fund Social Security and Medicare is a regressive tax, and it doesn't work very well. And folks have known that for years, and they're correct.
The poor pay a greater percentage of their income than the wealthy do.
On payroll.
The folks who make less money are paying in more percentage-wise.
Exactly. And Wendell Willkie, a Republican presidential candidate in 1944, made that very claim about why he wouldn't support a national health insurance program, because at least not the one proposed by the Democratic Party, because it relied on the payroll tax, and he was correct. So the fair tax proponents are correct in pointing out those two problems. However, the answer is not a national sales tax, which is what they've essentially proposed. Now, they'll generally argue that that's not what it is, and they do have an exemption for folks at the bottom of the of the income ladder so that they can argue on the basis of spending that it is a progressive structure. It is not, because if you look at it on the basis of income, which is all that matters, it would move the nation in a regressive manner. And if we had more time, I could talk about the problems with the arithmetic there as well. There's some substantial arithmetic problems associated with that proposal also.
Let's go back to the phones. Mike is on line one. Mike, you're on with economic historian David Shreve. Go right ahead.
Thank you. Actually, he hit on the point that I wanted to ask about the fare tax. My reading of it is that there would be a prebate up to the federal poverty level for spending to take care of your family for the basic needs of food, clothing, and that sort of thing. So, in fact, you would be getting all your money back that you paid into taxes up to the federal poverty line. I was just wondering if he could speak to that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a sense, that's one of the positive features of the fair tax proposal. However, what folks don't recognize readily enough is that what they're doing with that feature is essentially replicating something we already have, and that is the earned income tax credit, which offsets what you pay in payroll taxes and then some. So that if you put side by side the prebate feature of the fair tax with the way in which the earned income tax credit works, they're almost identical. So we have that right now. The part of the fair tax that really hurts, that would take us in the wrong direction, is the part that impacts the middle class, not the poor. The poor come out about the same they are now.
So you think the middle class would be worse off under a fair tax?
Oh, yes. And they would get hammered. I mean, that's where you make up the difference. And this is where the arithmetic problems come in, too, because the proponents have pretty vastly underestimated the rate at which you would have to impose a tax to make it revenue neutral. And
Do you mean to make about the same that we're making now?
Exactly.
The taxes on consumption would be astronomical.
It would. And then you've got this further problem once you recognize that, not only of hammering the middle class pretty hard, which is inescapable under this proposal, but also anytime you introduce that kind of a marginal price change, which is how it would be conveyed to the public.
Consumer goods would be a lot more expensive.
Well, you know, they argue that then the cost would diminish on the other side and it would all come out in the wash. But what we know from economic history is that anytime you have pricing policy in general in flux like that, that consumers are exploited. And so you have a lot of, you know, in theory, it sounds like there might be a wash for at some level, but you're going to have a lot of exploitation. It breeds an inflationary environment itself. And so then you get on this inflationary ladder that's difficult to avoid.
Mike, thank you for the call. Great question. We got a line open at 977-1070. We're talking economics with economic historian David Shreve, a member of the Virginia Organizing Project Tax Reform Committee. David, tell me about property tax. This whole idea that you have to pay a tax on your home that you're already paying the mortgage for, mm-hmm. and you're already paying, you know, you're paying to borrow that money to pay for the mortgage, which really hits us all. And you pay over decades for this home that you live in. You're also paying for the water and the electricity and all of that kind of stuff for the home. Mm-hmm. When did this start that we pay for this tax on our home, which that's the big tax I hate. Just American paying a tax on your very home, to me, doesn't make any sense.
No.
But when did this start, and when did localities come to rely on this just enormously? I mean, that's pays for our schools now.
It started in colonial America. What we need to realize, however, is that the property tax up until essentially the 19-teens was a proxy for income, which is why it was an attractive vehicle in the 18th and 19th centuries. And indeed, it generally tracked income so that you had typically two or three classes of American citizens affected by the property tax. You had a farmer who lived out in a remote area where the land values, because of the remoteness of the property, were extremely low. And this was income-producing property, farm produce, of course. The valuation of the land pretty closely tracked the ability of that farmer to produce income. So it was a proxy for income there. In the cities, and you didn't have suburbs back then, but so you moved to the cities, generally what you had there were landlords and tenants. And again, the property tax fell, if it was a real estate tax, on landlords who owned income-producing property, and it tended to track that as well. Well, by the time we move into certainly the middle of the 20th century, that's not true anymore for almost any of those classes of citizens. So that's the historical problem that we recognized. And as I told you in the break, governors in the 19-teens and 20s that got rid of state-level property taxes, which we seldom use anymore, thought they were killing it for good. And they were using that same kind of logic that I just laid out for you, that it no longer functioned as a proxy for income. It was archaic and regressive as well. They made that argument. The additional problem that cropped up, however, was that in the middle of the 20th century, localities came to shoulder a much greater fiscal responsibility for schools and education. And so here we have one of our worst tax vehicles in terms of its regressivity and it's not based on ability to pay, and it's got all kinds of quirks that make it a bad tax. It pays for one of the programs that we like the most, that is public education. And so it's difficult to disentangle the vehicle from that, because you have to come up with an alternative. And there are alternatives. And the easiest one, which would, in a sense, you could portray as a tax cut, would be to raise more revenue at the state level. The state pick up a little bit more of the tab for K-12 education, and the counties and the cities, the municipalities, could drop their property taxes.
Would that be great?
It's something that I encourage.
Yeah. We're talking with David Tree, but with the little time that we have left, can you talk a little bit about transportation in Virginia and when the Byrd machine took over the funding of transportation and made that a statewide issue, so that up until then, the rich areas had good roads and the bad areas, poor areas had, dirt roads at best. Mm-hmm. It became a state issue. And from what I've learned, that was one of the best things we ever did for business in Virginia, was this making that a statewide issue, funding the transportation infrastructure out of Richmond instead of relying on localities.
Indeed it was. What Governor Byrd did, he served from 1926 to 1930, was very much like what other governors around the country were doing at the same time.
So this
time.
Was a national trend.
It was a national trend. I would argue that Byrd was a little bit he was in the vanguard, however. And, it's well known that he brought in consultants from New York State to advise them on how to make this switch from local funding to state funding. He did two things with the Virginia tax structure to pay for it, to set it all up. One was to introduce a gasoline tax, which was also common around the country. The second was to rely on the state income tax, and he actually raised the top bracket rate by a percentage point to do this.
Yeah. The gas tax, though, not many people were driving back then.
Well, they weren't, and that's the other key to understanding that tax. And I think we fail to see that at the origin, and this all happened in the 1920s, virtually every state in the Union, and of course Alaska and Hawaii weren't around then, but the other 48 passed gasoline taxes in the 1920s, when automobile driving started to catch on and road building was catching on and all governors were doing this sort of thing. But in the middle of that decade, when all this was happening, you still had a minority of American families that owned cars. You didn't see a majority of families owning cars until the very end of that decade, and then, of course, you get hit by the Great Depression. It's pretty static for a while. It's a post-war boom that really...
So it was almost, originally, it was almost like a boat tax, almost.
Yeah, a luxury tax. It was passed. FDR was one of the first, as governor of New York, to get out on the stump and pass it in this fashion and to suggest that it was a luxury tax. Now, they knew good and well that putting these roads together, knitting together a state highway network, was going to be good ultimately for all citizens. But they saw that, the fat cats, the rich families that were driving cars, were the ones that probably could afford to pay for it at this point. And it made better sense. It's a very regressive user fee on which I think we should rely less today. It works on some level, but I think it's also an archaic vehicle, much like the property tax.
So what is the best way? Here's the million-dollar question with 30 seconds to answer it. How do we then fund transportation then?
Well, I would argue that one of the things you have to keep in mind is it's all fungible. So find out what you want to spend and then raise it in the most progressive and easiest fashion, and that's with a progressive income tax. Now, with roads, I would also argue that you should borrow because, again, these are long-term assets. They're going to pay dividends well into the future.
So bond construction.
Absolutely. It's a perfect way to do that. And, you know, Virginia's got a AAA bond rating. They won't lose it if they do this sort of a thing. In fact, I have argued on separate discussions that all 50 states should actually have AAA bond ratings if the bond rating agencies did it fairly.
David Shreve is an economic historian with the Virginia Organizing Project Tax Reform Committee, online at virginia-organizing.org. David, join us again, won't you?
I'd love to. Thank you for
enjoyed
inviting
it.
Me in.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.